You are listening to Radio Maria Canada. We now present the Health Hub, hosted by Kathy Biasi.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Health Hub. I'm Kathy Biasi, and along with our producer, Alex Diaz, we would like to welcome you to the show today. In fact, Alex is off doing some important work around the station. We have Daniel, who will be producing the show. So welcome, Daniel. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here with all of our Radio Maria listeners and all of our Health Hub listeners. It's nice to see you doing well, Kathy.
Thank you, Daniel. It's great. Alex is so busy around here, and you're doing a fantastic job. Daniel's actually produced a couple of the shows on the QT, and he's done a great job. So thank you, Daniel. As I've always said, it takes a village to do such a wonderful job on the show, so it's very much appreciated by myself. Today's show is live. Our number is 416-245-1534. You can reach out to us on our social sites. We are on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and our handle is at TheHealthHubRMC. And please feel free to email us at thh@radiomaria.ca. Our shows are all turned over into a podcast format, so please do subscribe to our podcast. We are The Health Hub, and we are on iTunes, SoundCloud, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. You can also find our podcasts on the Radio Maria Canada website, which is www.radiomaria.ca, and you can find them on my website, www.kathybiasi.com. And again, if you like what you hear, please feel free to leave us a comment. Our show last week, Functional Genomics with Dr. Mansoor Mohammed, is up and ready for you to listen to. My goodness, that was a very jam-packed podcast. We had so much information in that podcast. Daniel said last week at the end of the show, we're going to listen to that a couple of times to extract all the information, and I have. It was quite informative, so do take a listen to it if you have some time, and love to get your feedback on that. It was really a great show. So I wanted to talk to you today about osteoporosis and your bone health, but I want to framework this first by giving you an understanding of all of the functions that your bones have within your body. And contrary to what many, many people think, functions of the bone extend far beyond just holding us up and being an anchor for muscles and tendons. And it's important to understand the function of our bones so you can better grasp why taking care of them is so vital for your overall health. So along with support, our bones protect us. Our ribs cover many vital organs and very important part of the protection of our inner being. So that's one that you may have been familiar with. But the one that I think a lot of people are actually surprised by when I mention to this when I'm talking with people about the importance of bone health is that blood is produced in the marrow of your bones. So very important to understand that. So the health of your bones is important for your blood production. Your bones also are the storage place for many minerals, such as the commonly known one for bone health, which is calcium. And our bones release a hormone called osteocalcin. And this is also a very important hormone to be released for homeostasis within your body. And our bones do help to regulate sugar and fat deposits. So a very brief introduction to why your bones are important beyond the keeping us up sort of aspect of them. And that hopefully will set the framework for talking about osteoporosis, which I'm going to head into right now. Osteoporosis is a disease where the density and quality of the bone are reduced. Very, very common as we age. But I think what we need to understand is that laying the groundwork for bone health early in life will set the stage for healthy bones as we age. When this happens, the skeletal weakness is increased, and we are far more susceptible to fractures, especially of the spine, our wrist, hip, legs, and pelvis. And I think we had a guest on a while ago who said that, you know, when elderly people break their hip, it's a very, very tough road back to recovery. And many people do die of that. So it very, very important to keep our bones healthy. Osteoporosis, unfortunately, is often not diagnosed until a fracture happens. But there are a couple of signs. One is your height may shorten a little bit because of compression, and a curvature of the back. They may be really the only two physical symptoms of osteoporosis, but a decreased bone density and fractures are absolutely the height of risk for osteoporosis. Some people have bone density tests for various reasons, and that can set a benchmark for you, but those are the telltale signs of osteoporosis. As bone loss does increase, growth factors derived from our bones are released, and they can contribute to atherosclerosis, inflammation, calcification, and even cancer. As well, our bone density declines, inflammatory cytokines are released into the blood that can cause widespread inflammation. So what I want you to get from this is how important it is to take good care of your bones as you get older. And then with this next section, I'm just going to give you a couple of very meaningful ways to maintain the health of your bones. So two key areas. One is diet, of course. So maintaining a healthy diet and ensuring you're receiving key nutrients, which includes D3, K2, magnesium, calcium, boron, manganese, and zinc. Many of us, especially if we are still on the Western diet, do not get the amount we need through our diet. Oftentimes, a supplement is needed. So bearing in mind the minerals and vitamins that you need for proper bone health, take action if you're not getting them, and take some supplements to improve your bone health. And finally, weight-bearing exercises. Any activity that requires a forceful muscular contraction will potentially cause bone growth. And the greater demands you place on your skeletal system, the greater the response. So weight-bearing activities. And you don't have to bench press. You don't have to go to the gym every other day. But even walking up the stairs, picking up your groceries, picking up babies, things like that cause weight-bearing. Of course, the more you do, the heavier the weight, the more exertion on the bone, the better for your health. So I hope that gives you a couple of good ideas of how to keep your bones healthy, and a very good concept of how important your bones are for our overall health. And on to our show today. We are talking about the opioid crisis with Dr. Lloyd Sederer. And he is an adjunct professor at the Columbia School of Public Health. He is chief medical officer for the NYS Office of Mental Health, the nation's largest state mental health agency. And he is contributing writer for Psychology Today, the New York Journal of Books, and the New York Daily News, among other publications. He was medical editor for mental health for the HuffPost, where over 250 of his posts were published. He has served as mental health commissioner for NYC, medical director EVP for McLean Hospital, a Harvard teaching facility, and as director of clinical services for the American Psychiatric Association. He has written hundreds of articles on mental health, the addictions, and book, film, and TV theater reviews, and he has published dozens of books. His most recent book is The Addiction Solution, Treating Our Dependence on Opioids and Other Drugs. This is going to be a fascinating show, folks. We have had lots of people chime in with questions, so obviously it's a hot-button topic for many. Our learning points today, among others, are there valid reasons for using opioids? How did we get to this crisis point? And who is most impacted? We will be back in a few minutes.
You are listening to Radio Maria Canada. We now continue with the program, The Health Hub, hosted by Kathy Biasi.
Welcome back, everybody. Thumbs up again to that great music. Daniel, nice job. We are live today. Our number is 416-245-1534. If you'd like to call in, please do. I know you may feel a little bit anxious, but we're ready here to answer the phones. We've had a lot of questions that have been sent in to us, but if something strikes you, do give us a call. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We are at the Health Hub RMC. And again, email us at thh@radiomaria.ca. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lloyd.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. It's so great that you're covering this topic.
It is. And, you know, one of the questions that was sent in to us was, we're going to get to at some point, the difference between the impact of this in Canada and the U.S., because I think we get more notoriety from the U.S. But instead of getting ahead, let's just start at the beginning. Obviously, this is an issue that you take great, urgency in, and you've written this book. Why did you write this book? You've written so many things. Why this particular subject matter?
I wrote this book because we have an epidemic underway in this country. I don't know if it's been declared an epidemic in Canada, but the use and the deaths from opioids, which we need to define, continue to rise. This is regarded as an epidemic. It's killing too many people. And yet it's an epidemic that we can control. It's just that we're not applying some basic principles of public health to do so, and consequently the death rate continues to rise.
Well, you hit on something there at the beginning, because when I was doing some research on this, I don't know a lot about these types of medication. So maybe you can clarify for us what an opioid is, some of the common opioids that we might have heard from, and how they differentiate from other common classifications of drugs.
Please, but if I might make one additional comment about epidemics, because your listeners understand epidemics and understand how we've beaten back so many epidemics. Think of polio. Think of smallpox. Think of how we've reduced deaths from driving accidents, how we've reduced cigarette smoking, how we changed the landscape of HIV/AIDS. These were all epidemics, and they were killing too many people, and they're examples of how we can succeed and what we can learn and apply that to opioids. Now, opioids is a general term that umbrellas both naturally growing substances and synthetic made in labs, and they all essentially operate on the same receptor in the brain, the opioid receptor, the so-called mu receptor, and these include opium, morphine, Oxycontin, Vicodin, fentanyl, heroin. These are all opioids. They all work in the same way on the brain, whether they're taken by mouth or by syringe.
Well, you set a great framework saying that obviously you believe that there are ways to deal with this, but how did we get here?
A few things converged, at least in the United States, and I suspect migrated north as well. About 20 years ago, pain was recognized as underdetected and undertreated. Too many people were in too much pain and not receiving medication for their pain. And in the United States, that turned into a standard. Hospitals and doctors had to measure pain. And some of you may have seen this, these smiley to unhappy faces, 0 to 10 pain rating scales. And they became standardized in the delivery of health care. And many people reported 8 or 9 as their score. At the same time, the pharmaceutical industry, particularly one major producer and distributor, Purdue Pharmaceuticals, the manufacturers, distributors of OxyContin, promoted its use enormously in this country, claiming that it did not cause addiction. And basing that on some two insubstantive reports, but marketed this enormously to doctors and patients. So suddenly we were measuring pain, and we were told we have an effective treatment that has no addictive potential. That set the stage for the growth and use and consequently abuse of these substances. More recently, in the past 10 or 15 years, it seems, in, at least in this country, the changing use, the changing demographics, where these substances are used by whom, more middle class, middle America people, seems related to what we call diseases of despair. Unemployment, lack of prospects, chronic pain, and little prospects for themselves or their children. These are the environments that produce risk. They've always produced risk in inner cities for use of heroin and other opioids, and now that's spread. So we have measurement, we have medications, and we have social malaise, and these all come together, and we have an epidemic.
You mentioned that 20 years ago an epidemic of pain started. You're talking physical pain?
Yes, these were these pain scales were specifically about physical pain, people's pain that might be in their bones, in their joints, in their heads, didn't matter. But I think you're implying here, really importantly, that people use opioids also for relief of psychic pain. They're very effective for people who have trauma and suffer emotionally because they mitigate pain. They mitigate physical pain and they mitigate psychological pain.
So are these being prescribed in the psychiatric field as well as within the pain management field? They're being prescribed on both
actually
fronts?
Actually not. Psychiatrists never started prescribing opioids for the variety of conditions that are common in our practices, depression, trauma, psychotic, bipolar disorder. We kept our prescribing to non-opioids, antidepressants, antipsychotics, anti-anxiety medications. It was the general medical field that began the enormous prescription and over-prescription of opioids.
So you said that early on, as these medications were being formulated, that it was stated that they're not addictive. So are these now, do we know now, or do you know now that these are physiologically addictive, or are they addictive because of the feeling that we're getting from them, or is it a combination of the two? Where do we stand on the addiction front?
Indeed, it is a combination of the two, and it's indisputable. For a person who uses 3-4 pills of OxyContin, no less heroin, for a week, they start to experience craving, which is the result of their body having developed some early dependence, some wanting more of the same stuff that helped them, that relieved their physical or emotional pain. So these are, some people discover also, not even without physical, may have kids whose friends give them these pills or adults who get a hold of these pills, they discover, oh boy, they hardly ever felt this good in their life. That's how powerful and effective these opioids are. And consequently, people then try to repeat that experience, find more drugs to do the same thing.
So where are we now with this? Are these still being prescribed readily by the medical field, or has this now become an issue of illegal drug use?
Doctor prescriptions, at least in the United States, for opioids have gone down, not in a major way, but in a significant way for the past 2 years. But deaths continue to rise. And that has to do with the inaccessibility of the pills. Pills are harder to get. They're more expensive. And if you're dependent on OxyContin, Vicodin, and your doctor says, I'm not going to do this anymore, you know, that everybody's watching me because we are, they begin to then shut down the supply of opioids for people who have been on them for a long time, some of them actually well managed on the medication. And what does a person then do? They're in withdrawal. This withdrawal from opioids is a really lousy state. It feels awful. And there's only one solution, which is more opioids. So they can't spend $500 on pills. They can't get pills, even from the black market. They purchase heroin. Heroin is the cheap, accessible, and as effective or more effective pain reliever as are these pills. So we've seen a shift from pills and overdose deaths from pills to a shift back to heroin, which is preceded the opioid pills, and greater deaths from the heroin. And finally, that's related to the fact that the heroin is now mixed or laced with even more potent synthetic drugs like fentanyl, which is highly deadly. So so we've seen a shift in what people are using and how deadly the substances are.
What is in place in the medical field of the opioids now?
Well, the two most important medications that actually are enormously life-saving and are not highly used. One is the reversal drug. This is called naloxone or Narcan. You see this with first responders. Somebody has taken an overdose and they spray some of this medication in a nose or they inject it into a muscle. And within seconds, somebody wakes up, no matter how comatose they may be, how depressed their respirations may be, can't revive a dead person. But naloxone is the antidote, and in my state, it is available without a prescription. So we're trying to get this life-saving medication not just in the hands of first responders, but into families and friends who recognize that there is opioid use going on around them. The second is a treatment medication. And it's called buprenorphine. Its trade name is Suboxone. And it is a pill or a film tab taken daily by somebody who has an opioid, has a heroin or OxyContin addiction. And this is a substitute medication, and it doesn't get people as high, and it's very, very hard to overdose on it because of the nature of the drug. And in France, when this medication was introduced almost 20 years ago, overdose deaths from opioids, from heroin, dropped by 80% within 3 years. And so this is life-saving medication, and for some people, it's a use is for a year. For some, it is for a very long time because they have a chronic condition. Those are the two principal life-saving medications that we have that we're just not using enough of.
There was, it's funny enough because when we spoke last week, you and I on the phone and we were talking about our show, within a day, I think, it came on the radio that, and across the television wires as well, that the Ontario is now allowing police to administer naloxone without worry of retribution if it's a... So I'm not 100% sure of what was going on there. I guess perhaps there were probes into the police using the naloxone. And now I think, so obviously with that legislation coming through or whatever you want to call that, that we do have an issue here, at least in Ontario. So
that's great to hear. And I hope that extends beyond police and first responders to families affected by this epidemic. Because they can come upon a loved one who has overdosed.
Just before we go to break here, just along that front here with the naloxone, people on opioids, are they dangerous when the police are approaching them?
Generally the contrary, speaking? Mostly they're highly sedated, or if the police have been called, they're hardly breathing.
Okay.
Because opioids depress respiration. So, no, this is unlike some other other drugs that in the past were regarded as excitatory, whether they're stimulants or PCP, angel dust. Those sometimes produced very aggressive reactions in the user. This is not the case with opioids.
Okay, so the police are being allowed to use this as a life-saving strategy then. So that's That's good to hear. It was just an odd timing of that to come up after we had just spoken.
That's great to hear.
It is good to hear. This is a natural pause here for us to take a break, because when we come back, I really want to get more into some demographics and things. So we'll take a break for a few minutes and we'll be back with Dr. Lloyd.
You are listening to The Health Hub here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. To contact us and be a part of the show, please call 416-245-1534. We now continue with the program. Here once again is your host, Kathy Biasi.
Welcome back, everybody. We are here with Dr. Lloyd Sederer, and we're talking about the opioid crisis. You can reach out to us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. We are at the Health Hub RMC on all three, and our email is thh@radiomaria.ca. I just would like Dr. Lloyd to acknowledge that we have covered some of the questions that are sent in by our listeners, and it's probably a good point to add in a couple. And again, if these are out of your area of knowledge, we're talking a little bit more about demographics on one of them, just, you know, feel free and we can perhaps look that up ourselves. So a few of the questions that were asked, what has caused the opioid problem? And I do believe, is there anything more you'd like to say on that front?
There is, of course, the human element, which is that people use these drugs because they serve them, they help them until they don't. And that's really an essential thing to understand, because these are not bad people, weak people. These are people who have pain, physical pain, emotional pain, or just want to get away from the everyday grind. And these medications work. They work immediately, powerfully. And so there's the human element, and that need for pain relief is greater, of course, in people who have early trauma, who have lives of displacement, who have lives where they're subject to violence. So there is the human element in addition to all the social and prescribing activity that's gone on.
Okay. Another question is, do you think that opioids are the worst drug problem that we're facing?
No.
Okay.
The biggest killers are tobacco and alcohol.
Okay.
By huge margins. So, from a public health point of view, the biggest cause of illness and death in the world is tobacco. And after that, it's alcohol, and then you slide down a few levels, and we have opioids.
Okay, fair enough. Is the opioid issue all about pain? I think we're broaching that subject now. Initially, the opioids were about pain, but has this crossed over into mental health?
Well, it's always been about not just physical pain, but emotional pain. And it is a mental health problem. And some people with existing mental health problems, serious depression, trauma disorders, may come upon an opioid and discover this takes away their pain. And they are then driven, if you will, by need to relieve that kind of pain, just like somebody who has cancer pain or bone pain.
So it's just a personal question. Do you think that the issuance and the usage of opioids has increased as we have become more and more aware of mental health?
I don't know if it's because we've become more aware of mental health. I mean, that awareness has importantly grown in the past 10 or 20 years, which has reduced the stigma and I think made more people recognize or be able to understand what they're suffering from and get help. So we may have more awareness, but I don't know if that's a factor in people using more these substances.
Okay, and another question, this may be a little bit difficult for you to answer, but I'll ask it anyways. Are opioids an issue in Canada as well?
I think they're an issue in most every country, though I am unfortunately not familiar with the rate of overdose deaths in Canada or what's happened with prescribing of these drugs north of the United States border. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine. And the last question I have at the moment, are opioids coming from within the U.S. border, or are they being imported?
They're principally being smuggled in, particularly the synthetic drug fentanyl. It's easy to smuggle in fentanyl because it takes tiny amounts to do a lot of damage. Like a grain or two of salt is enough to kill everybody in your studio. So it's easy to smuggle in. It's principally manufactured in China and smuggled into the United States through our ports. There are now some labs emerging in the United States, and I wouldn't be surprised in Canada as well, to manufacture fentanyl because it's so profitable and it's easily synthesized. So this is coming from within and without.
And the fentanyl is being cut into the opioids. That's an issue that you brought up earlier?
Yes. Yes. So if you're a dealer or if you're somebody with a heroin addiction, for example, the dealer has to buy heroin. It's more bulky. A tiny little bit, a grain of fentanyl in a bag will make that bag 10 or 20 times more powerful. And you can sell it for more money and with a lower cost. And for people who are dependent on heroin, they've been using for a while, and the stuff that they're buying is usually cut dramatically, so they barely get enough to overcome their withdrawal. So even the user is eager for more powerful substances, and they're consequently at risk.
So you have to graduate with potency. You get used to one level, you level off, and you have to increase the potency for the same effect?
Yes.
Okay.
That's called tolerance.
Okay. Now, the demographic of the people that are most heavily impacted, is there within the United States a particular demographic that is emerging?
Yes. It's not that poor people and people of color, inner city people, aren't still substantially affected or involved with heroin. It's just that white, middle-class, middle Americans are now the bursting population, and this has been the case for the past 10 years, talking about the Midwest, talking about Ohio, Pennsylvania, west and going south, West Virginia, going north, Maine and New Hampshire. These have become epicenters of OxyContin and now heroin and fentanyl distribution.
Why is that? Is there a logical reason?
Well, some of the patterns followed truck routes. Those would be natural distribution points for people to gather by from a truck that was smuggling in. And then there is also this social dimension that these are hard hit economically and otherwise areas of the United States. Jobs are down. Prospects are poor. Many people have been manual laborers and they have chronic pain, arthritic pain, just from building houses or being carpenters or working in factories. So this is access has grown because the dealers see this is a, there's a market out there, and there's a market that is emotionally suffering and that has a fair amount of physical pain.
Okay, we just had a question emailed into us. Is there an issue with mom to baby as far as pregnancy? Can babies be born addicted to opioids?
Yes.
Okay.
It's not an uncommon occurrence, and babies, newborns have to be detoxified. They have to be withdrawn safely over a number of days because the opioid passes through the placenta to the fetus, and the fetus is born dependent on the drug.
Okay. So let's turn this around. We've got sort of the negative aspect of all of this. We've got everything in place. Your book gives hope in many different ways. And you identified 10 factors for determining how an individual interact with the psychoactive. So maybe are these points, do you want to get out, like the most, who might be most susceptible to have interaction? So let's talk about that, and then we're going to get to the positive aspects of how this can be turned around. So you have these 10 key factors. So maybe you want to dive into the most important ones that you would like to discuss?
Sure. They all represent examples of how we humans are active ingredients in our experience, what happens to us when we take a drug. It's not just the drug, it's the person. So, for example, a person who has had early life full of neglect or abuse, a person who has been incarcerated, a person who is a combat veteran exposed to all kinds of trauma, these are internal dimensions, the interior that a person brings to their experience of a drug, puts them at risk. Those are conditions that put people at much higher risk because they're in pain and their mind, their soul is looking for some relief. So the interior, our psychology, our background, our trauma experience, this counts. In addition, the environment in which we live is another risk factor. And perhaps the best examples there pertain to combat soldiers. When you live or in a world where every day your life is threatened, where you see your fellow soldiers injured or murdered, this environment produces risk because it's such an unbearable environment. And we know that soldiers, particularly in Southeast Asia years ago, used a tremendous amount of heroin to cope with being in the jungles, to cope with being endangered every day. Age is another factor, and then maybe we can move beyond, but age is very important, particularly now that cannabis has been legalized in Canada and increasingly available in the United States. It makes a very big difference if a person starts using cannabis when they're 12, when they're 20, or when they're 30. And the reason for that is our brains are under construction well into our 20s, even longer for young men than women. And when we have a brain under construction, what that means is the brain is still maturing and it's laying down myelin, which helps its conduction and helps us function better. But while that's under construction, high doses, highly potent cannabis, which is what is available now, can get in the way of that development. So for youth, one of the messages is, not now. See how long you can put it off. It's not that you're necessarily going to never use this, but you might want to think about your brain under construction.
Wow, I have so many questions. I just want to ask about that last comment, but I think I'll avoid them at the moment because that's a complete other show. But so where do we go from here? What policies would you like to see in place? Is there one single course of action? Let's really get into the really end off things here on the real high positive note.
Great. The public health approach is pretty basic. It starts with prevention. How can we keep people from using these substances? And that starts with youth and that starts with families. And this is about teaching youth skills, cognitive skills, decision-making skills. Otherwise, how are they going to respond when another kid comes up, in the fifth grade lunchroom and says, "Do you want to smoke some of this pot?" We can teach kids skills, we can teach them about their brains, and we can teach families about what's protective. Families that spend time together, this is a well-established finding that if you have dinner with your kids, they're much less likely to turn to troublesome behavior, including drugs. So prevention is where everything starts. And then with any chronic disease, because addiction is a chronic disease, early detection is essential. The sooner that a disease is identified, whether it's high blood pressure or cancer, the more likelihood we have of being able to help somebody beat it. And that's about screening. That's about in schools and in primary care practices, asking and measuring use of substances, including tobacco, in order to detect it early. And then there's treatment. And treatment is always best when it combines different approaches. This is a tough disease to overcome. So a reliance just on 12-step recovery programs, AA, is not sufficient. Reliance on medications alone, like we were talking about, buprenorphine, Suboxone, and some others, is also important but not sufficient. There are cognitive therapies, ways that help people control their triggers. So relapse with drugs is about triggers. It's about seeing somebody use, a friend calling up who's high, watching something on television. And we can learn about our triggers and how to mitigate them. And there are motivational techniques. When we put these all together, these are very effective treatments, and people can get into recovery, stay alive.
Are there policies that you have in mind that you think that could be put into place to further the prevention and to decrease the crisis?
Yes. And here in New York State, for example, we're working to make screening, to make the standardized questions about substance use as common as taking your blood pressure in primary care. That's a way of doing that. Doing that in schools is also a really good policy, but schools are more hesitant to do that, I think in part because they have so few resources, and it's not their, you know, it's not they're not a disease treatment site, just like schools don't take your blood pressure. Or your sugar levels, but schools that have health clinics, yes. So these are policies about detecting the problem and then effective treatment. Effective treatment combines these different approaches, gives somebody a chance.
And I'm assuming these are state by state policies.
On the policy side, in mental health clinics, we're going to require mental health clinics to prescribe Suboxone, the maintenance medication for people with addiction, and to help with dispensing naloxone. You don't need a prescription. And we're going to do that. We're going to step up because it turns out not an insignificant number of people who go for mental health care are using opioids or even have an opioid disorder. So we're going to join the existing specialty substance use field where you can get these medications, but it's a very limited resource. There are not many substance use clinics. There are a lot more mental health clinics. We're going to step up, and we're going to contribute by trying to help these people in mental health settings where they often come for depression or other kinds of problems. And we also want to see this happen in primary care settings, and I think that will happen, but that's not immediately on the horizon, at least not in New York.
Well, I was just going to ask you,
there are some exceptions, but as a rule, as a policy, it hasn't happened.
Have you seen any light at the end of the tunnel? Unfortunately, this is going to have to be the last question here. But have you seen any light at the end of the tunnel, or is this just too new of a tackle that you are initiating right now?
No, there are early signs that this is starting to take root. There have been so much media like yourself pointing this out, pointing out that there are effective ways to mitigate this epidemic, to help people stay alive. So even the story about the police in Canada, I mean, these are ways by which slowly we're changing the culture so that people are kept alive and treated.
I have one other question that just popped in, and I think we have time for it right down here. Is there application for opioids, or are these should these just be pulled right out of practice, or can you still?
That would be a mistake. That would be a true overreaction.
So there
If I fracture my arm, if I have surgery, I want these medications, and they are really good, effective pain relievers for a period of days.
So we need to
enable people to recover and mobilize, which is so essential to recovering from any trauma or surgery. So these are effective drugs, and we need them, but we have to be careful with them.
So we need vigilance on the medical end, really, is what we're talking about. Okay,
yes.
Perfect. Now, your book, where can we find your book? It's called let me just grab the title here, make sure that I get it absolutely correct. It is called The Addiction Solution, Treating Our Dependence on Opioids and Other Drugs. Where can we find your book, Dr. Lloyd?
You can find it on Amazon. You can find it from my publisher, Simon & Schuster. And perhaps even your local bookstore, but online is much more reliable.
Except we have a strike going on here in Canada with our post system, so try and get it at the bookstore if you want to give it around the holiday season. Now, your Twitter handle is Ask Dr. Lloyd, AskDrLlOyd. Anything else you would like, any other social media handles you'd like to give us, or is this your main one?
That's the main one.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. It's quite a conversation. It's something that I think needs to be brought to the forefront. And I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us, Dr. Lloyd. And everybody, we will talk to you next week on the Health Hub.
Have been listening to The Health Hub, hosted by Kathy Biasi, here on Radio Maria Canada.